Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. First item on the agenda today is a presentation from the DNR on wildlife fisheries as well as the Roadsides for Wildlife program. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, Assistant Commissioner. The presentations we have today are in three parts. I believe they are in front of your desk there. The first part is an overview, which I'm going to run through rather quickly. Some of you have seen this information in the Finance Committee or are aware of it, so I wanted to give it to you for a historical context, a record for you to take with you so you can see some of this information. Then Ed Bogus, our Assistant Director for the Fish and Wildlife Division, will be talking about the Fish and Wildlife Division in more detail, talking about specific duties, responsibilities, and programs that are there. And then the third part of our presentation this afternoon will be from Carmelita Nelson, discussing our Roadsides for Wildlife program and what's going on there. With that, the overview presentation, it just says DNR, an organization, an overview. It's the color one that's there, just so you see that. I just want to bring to your attention a few slides talking about our organizational structure, missions, goals, and how we work. If you look on slide two, the DNR mission statement, we work with the citizens of Minnesota to conserve and manage the state's natural resources, provide outdoor recreation opportunities, and provide for commercial uses of natural resources in ways that create a sustainable quality of life. Our number one priority is the conservation of the state's natural resources. But then in combination with that, we need to utilize the needs that people have to recreate and also to make a living and the economic benefits from our natural resources as well. The third slide on your presentation, I don't have a PowerPoint on this, members. I just have the paper handouts for you. Ed Bogus will have a PowerPoint, and so will Carmelita. The third slide dealing with the integrated decision-making really highlights how we take our mission statement into practice. The three circles you see, recreation use, economic use, and natural resources conservation, outline the three legs of the stool from our mission statement. In the middle where you see the DNR letters, that's really where we operate on a day-to-day basis, taking all of those needs into consideration. If we stray too far into one of those other circles, we often have problems. We must find management solutions that address the conflicts and interdependencies between the conservation and the use of multiple natural resources. A good example of this, and one that you're all well aware of, I know, is the management of the forest. If we fail to have a healthy forest estate, there'll be less timber for harvest, fewer places for hunting, and less access to forests and hiking and wildlife watching, and our forests won't be healthy. We need to manage our forests, which are a truly sustainable resource, by harvesting, by sustainable use, in order to continue the regeneration. So that kind of, to me, reflects those three circles all working together. The next slide discusses partnerships briefly. We do this through a lot of partnerships. As you know, in your areas, you have a lot of groups, stakeholder groups. We work with hundreds and hundreds of stakeholder groups throughout the state on many, many different issues. Sharing the stewardship, we work directly with citizens, stakeholder groups, the local chapters of Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, Trout Unlimited, lake owners associations, recreational groups, and all levels of government. And setting priorities, providing technical expertise, and managing natural resources. And I need to stress at all levels of government. Working with county and local governments are very important to us being able to succeed in our mission. Without the support and buy-in at the local level, we can't succeed. Just as you know, the programs that you implement have to be done at a statewide and driven down to the local community. When we go in to purchase land, manage lands, do recreational opportunities, we're working with the county boards hand in hand, talking with them, addressing their needs, and for the most part, working with them in partnerships to do the work that we need to do. This is where the conflict comes in sometimes. If we don't work with the counties and listen to them, we often have a lot of conflict. As we have conflict on a daily basis that we try to manage. Northwestern Minnesota, the pressures up there with public land, and much like the Northeast, public land ownership issues, how those lands are managed, the amount of land managed, they're all very critical to how those areas function. Working with those local decision makers is something we take very seriously. And then balancing the multiple interests, working together to make sure that we're addressing the competing interests in ways that ensure sustainable use. it's all based upon relationships, and we try to do our best to maintain those relationships, improve the relationships where we can, and strengthen them at every opportunity. Moving on to slide 5, just shows the organization of the DNR right now by region. We did realign the central region, you'll see this says as of January 2007, to more closely fit with the Mississippi River corridor down there, just because that does present its own set of management natural resource circumstances, so it fits more with the central region. Just quickly, our northeast region is located in Grand Rapids, headed up by regional director Craig Engwall. Northwest is over in Bemidji, headed up by Mike Carroll. The central region is here down on Warner Road, headed up by Joe Kersinka. And the southern region is over in New Ulm, headed up with Cheryl Heidi. You may or may not have met these individuals yet, but I know they're in the process of meeting with all of you members on the Environment and Environment Finance Committee, so you know who your regional directors are to establish that relationship. Oftentimes, this will be or should be your first point of contact with an issue you have in your region. So, and always, you know, I'm always available as a resource, as all of our division directors are. Just quickly, the next slide talks about the DNR organization. I want to give you a flavor for not only the regional organization, but how the central office is laid out as well. You can see on the top the commissioner's office, deputy, myself, and assistant commissioner for operations. And we move over to operations support, which houses many of our bureaus, our information education bureau, human resources, management, budget services, the things that we need to operate efficiently on a day-to-day basis. On the other side, under operations, you see the regional operations. And then each of the divisions fall under their forestry, enforcement, waters, parks and recreation, lands and minerals, trails and waterways, ecological services, and fish and wildlife. We have staff represented from these divisions at the regional level functioning as a regional management team to address the issues in the field from a multi-jurisdictional, if you want to call it, level. When we look at planning, for example, we have members from ecological services there, from forestry, from fish and wildlife, lands and minerals, making sure that those decisions that we make as a region and as an agency are supported across divisions, taking all of the individual concerns into consideration. The next slide, I just want to give you a little flavor for how our budget is laid out right now. This kind of goes back to 2004-05. Current biennium and where we're at in the next biennium with the governor's budget recommendations. General fund, as a lot of our divisions are general funded. Some of them don't have any general fund to them. Fish and Wildlife, for example, only receives 3% of its funds from the general fund. The rest of the money that are funded, fund those activities of that division, come from the users who buy fishing licenses, hunting licenses, other types of licenses out there. And that's why we are very concerned when issues about free licenses or license reductions come up. We take them very seriously. We work with our Budget Oversight Committee, which I'm hoping to get in front of this committee to talk with you about what they do. They take their role very seriously. And I also have opened the invitation to the Finance Committee, but I want to open it to you folks as well to come to one of our meetings with the Budget Oversight Committee. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month starting at 5:30 at our office down on University Avenue. You let me know and I'll get you a box lunch. They get some mileage in box lunches, but the work they do is very important to us, and they would love to have you there and to meet you and discuss their issues with you. But our funding, you can see, I just want to give you a little historical context right now. We're spending a lot of time in Senator Anderson's committee talking about that, and we appreciate that. So just those of you who aren't on the Environment Finance Committee, you can understand where we've been and where we're going, kind of at a broad level. Bless you. The next slide, I just want to spend a little bit of time going through some of the overall, or drilling down a little bit more into the budget. Because of PILT, payment in lieu of taxes, is such a large part of some of our general funds, I want to make sure you're aware of that. You can see here, overall general fund, $221 million, 32%. The payment in lieu of taxes is through $33 million of that in fiscal year 06-07, which will be increasing to $41 million in the next biennium. Another big piece of that general fund is our firefighting appropriations, which is an open appropriation. standing for next year, about $18 million. You may have seen the news story last week talking about the precipitation levels, the moisture levels out there, and if something doesn't change, we may be in for a more catastrophic fire season this year than we had last year, which is one of the worst on record. So just generally how the budget lays out there. The next slide on page 9 just shows the Game and Fish Fund appropriations. $182 million, a small portion of that, as I mentioned, was general fund, and over 60% of it. Actually, if you look at the license fees and then the federal license or the federal dollars we get through sports, fish, and wildlife programs, Pittman Robertson, Wallop Perot, that adds up to almost 80% of the division's budget. So a lot of it comes directly from the activities that they manage and the people who experience and utilize those programs. The next couple of slides.
You said the division's budget. Does that mean that the Game and Fish Fund is completely under the Game and Fish Division?
Mr. Chair, members. Game and Fish Fund dollars are expended on other Game and Fish and Wildlife related activities. Ecological Services receives a portion for the work that they do. Also enforcement, the Division of Enforcement, because they are upholding and enforcing the Game and Fish laws, receives some money from Game and Fish funds as well.
Okay.
There are statutory parameters established on those funds, and many of our stamp accounts, or all of our stamp accounts, I should say, have very specific statutory requirements. And that is one thing that we really take to heart, is the fund integrity of using these dollars, of any of our dollars that come from users based on fees, be it fishing license, hunting license, snowmobile, cross-country ski pass. We strive at our utmost to make sure those dollars are used for the purposes that they were paid for and what those people paid their dollars to have.
Thank you.
Thank you for bringing that point up. The next slide just talks about a lot of those other accounts that we have, just so you get an idea of the Natural Resources Fund, where all of those license dollars go into and exactly what they're related to. Water rec, of course, comes from boats, snowmobiles from snowmobile registrations. And we just have a number of different accounts and licenses. I think the DNR budget is probably one of the more complicated that are out there, just because of our stakeholders and our broad bases. I look at them as customers that are working with us to provide funds to do the activities that they want to do. Briefly, the next slide on page 11 discusses lottery in lieu of the sales tax. Now, this is something that was put in statute years ago, dealing with the amount of money that comes off of the sale of the lottery tickets. Since 1990, the legislature has imposed an in-lieu sales tax of lottery tickets. This money previously went to the general fund. In 2000, the legislature started talking about what to do with these dollars, and in 2003, you folks actually established that only 27.5% roughly of the lottery and loose sales tax dollars went into the general fund. The remaining 72.5% go what we call lottery and loo dollars are split between fish and wildlife and then the natural resources fund used for metro parks, state parks, local trail grants, and zoos. You can see that slide there talking about how $41.3 million were appropriated last biennium under lottery and loo sales tax for those programs. 50% to the Heritage Enhancement Account, which were then directly legislatively appropriated to the department or for other specific purposes, and then the other percent into the Natural Resources Fund.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Clarify for me, Mr. Meyer, if the lottery in lieu versus the Environmental Trust Fund. Now, is it lottery money goes into the Environmental Trust Fund, does it not? Is that what you're talking about here? Or is that something, is this the remainder that didn't get constitutionally dedicated, a reallocation of that back into natural resources?
Mr. Chair, Meyer. Senator Olson, the lottery in lieu dollars come from, when you buy a scratch-off ticket, you pay $1. You don't pay $1.07. The state allocates the sales tax that would have been collected. Well, actually, I think it works that only the sales tax is paid for, in essence, within that dollar. Those funds then are transferred from the general fund into, well, they're transferred from that account into either the lottery in lieu account or the general fund at that 27.57% into the general fund, and then 72.43% into that's split between the Heritage Enhancement Account and then the Natural Resources Fund. The profit, or the net proceeds, I believe the way it's written, go into the trust, of which the LCCMR spends off of the interest that's earned off of that account.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry for any confusion I might have caused on that. The next slide just talks about our budget again, direct, open, and statutory appropriations by division. You can see each division there and the amount of money that they receive. Again, I'm not going to go through that in detail, but it's just something for you to have as we work through some of these issues this session. Looking at the slide with the natural resource challenges on slide number 13, this kind of relates to those three circles, but this is what we're seeing on the ground and how we view a bunch of these issues interacting. On the top with the landscape change, habitat loss and fragmentation, the parcelization of the forest issues, climate change that we're facing, and on the bottom are our clients or our stakeholders, you and I, who want to enjoy our natural resources, public access, connection to natural resources, renewable energy use. Those are very serious issues. The way I look at this, going from the bottom where we want to do things and how do we get to the top, the other issues in the middle are some of that we're facing right now. Changing development patterns, the forest, as I mentioned, urbanization of our metropolitan, and pretty soon we'll have an 11-county metropolitan area, just where the growth is right now. Changes in agriculture with the opportunities for biofuel development, native prairie, carbon sequestration issues that we're talking about and are so serious are going to have some impacts on our landscape changes. Harmful invasive species and diseases. I know we've talked a little bit about the emerald ash borer, but also curly leaf pondweed, milfoil, zebra mussels, and the ones that we don't even know that are on their way over here right now are going to impact the way that we use our lands. And also clean water and the sustainable use of water. Those are just some of the major challenges that we face right now and that we're trying to deal with as we develop our budget and our programmatic activities. Also, the next slide talks about some of these indicators that we have, and I need to get you a copy of this report. I'm going to try to wait till March when the new edition comes out with our tracking indicators, our strategic conservation agenda. We have over 90 indicators we're tracking related to fish and wildlife, waters, ecological services, forestry, trails and waterways. It's kind of our report card if you want to look at that and where we need to go. So we have a new edition coming out on March 2007, which we can get to you. Also, you can see the web link there. All of these previous editions are up on our website. So if you want to go in and take a look at where we're at and some of the indicators we have, many of them presented in the reports you're seeing or presentations, you can click on that link. If you're interested in a copy of that now, I can get you a copy of the 2006 one right today. The DNR programs on the next slide, I just want to give you an overview. We've talked about them, but the individuals, Marty Vadas in Lands and Minerals, Cortland Nelson, Parks and Recreation, Forrest Bowe, Trails and Waterways, Lee Fanmuller from Ecological Services, Dave Shad, Fish and Wildlife, Colonel Mike Hamm from Enforcement, David Epperle, Forestry, Kent Lacasmo from Waters, and Denise Anderson with our Operations Support Division. These are the folks that you are meeting right now. You may have met some of them, or you will be meeting more of them, that deal with these programmatic issues that we are dealing with as we discuss policy changes, budget items, and all of our day-to-day activities on the division. So I just want to give you the chance to think of the names and in the future put the faces with the names. The remainder of the presentation here just outlines what the core functions of each of the divisions are, and I know the committee's heard from Forestry Division. We've talked about invasive species, ecological services a little bit. Rather than go through these in detail, I want to just leave them with you as a reference so you can look at these. I know you have a lot of stuff on your agenda today, a couple more presentations from us. But it outlines the core functions of each of our divisions, lands and minerals, fiduciary responsibility to the trust. They do all of our real estate transactions, make sure that when we are buying wildlife management areas, state park acquisitions, working with local units of government on land sales issues. Those are types of issues lands and minerals deal with. Parks and recreation, the core functions, preserve, restore, and interpret our state's natural and cultural resources. Operation of the parks, making sure that our customers have a clean and safe environment to go to, and that our resources in those parks are protected are the core functions there. Trails and waterways.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Parasol.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question of Mr. Meyer, and not to take you back, but to lands and minerals.
Yes.
How does the ratio of management over aggregate resources in the state between DNR and anybody else shake out? I mean, where is the responsibility for making sure not just identification, but keeping the aggregate resources in mind as well?
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, Senator Parasol, aggregate resources are dealt with at the resource level, mainly with the counties. We do aggregate mapping throughout the state to help counties identify their aggregate resources, but aggregate use is really a local issue, transportation, the mining of those things, and we work with the counties, but the counties have the overall oversight of many aggregate activities.
That's
of course, when you get in, there's overlays, shoreland, if you're next to a water body, there's issues there, depending on how it impacts the resources and where the mining or the aggregate bed would be, we would become involved if there are pressing natural resource issues involved with the mining.
And I asked the question from the standpoint that, as far as I could tell, it was mostly the counties who did have that authority. But at the same time, to make sure that those resources aren't wasted by being built over before they're used is one of the concerns I have, because there are some precious ones out there that are in some regions. They just don't have that many other large aggregate resources remaining. Some of them have been built over, like a city we both know, and more than one city in that county.
Mr. Chair, Senator Parasol, that is an example of how we work with our local units of government, developing those partnerships and sharing information, letting them know where the resources are. But ultimately, it's their zoning and ordinances that allow that development to take place, which we do not have any authority to supersede,
okay.
Unless you want to give us some.
I just wanted to check on that. Thank you very much.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, slide number 15. Can you tell me how many FTEs these people supervise in the state of Minnesota? Or is that in here someplace?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Just to give me an idea.
Roughly, the department has on a yearly total about 2,800 FTEs. Many of those are seasonal or temporary based upon, you know, parks. We hire a lot of seasonal temporary park people. Some of our forestry people are seasonal on a seasonal basis. I can get you more detailed information on that and get the committee a list of that if you desire.
I would really like
by
to
division see. Or total aggregate?
I'm mostly considered, Mr. Chair, the full-time employees. That's all. By division would be great. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks.
Any other questions before I move on? I know I'm going through this rather quickly, but I know some of you have this information or have seen it before, so I'm just trying to get us all to the same spot. I believe I left off on slide number 18, talking about trails and waterways. Their core functions are to deal with our users of our natural resources, non-motorized, motorized, water recreation, hiking, biking trails, snowmobile, ATV, horse trails, also all of our water accesses, our boat ramps, our public fishing piers are all operated out of the Trails and Waterways Division. Again, another division that's heavily funded by the users of those opportunities, so that they have a smaller general fund portion. Ecological services, our environmental review activities are overseen in the Ecological Services Division. Also, our invasive species programs, dealing with all the bugs and plants that we've talked about here, come out of here. Also, the technical assistance that we provide for the local units of government related to Clean Water Legacy Act, development, shoreland management, things of that nature come out of this division. We do have several budget proposals related to ecological services that you may hear or you will hear about in the future. Fish and wildlife, Ed's going to talk about that here in a few minutes. So it's dealing with our plants and animals and fish that we utilize on a daily basis, or we'd like to try to get out and enjoy maintaining those populations, conducting the inventory, propagation, and technical assistance in education. Department of, or Division of Enforcement, as I mentioned, oversee all the rules and regulations that we have out there, from fish and wildlife also to trails and waterways, forestry, things of that nature. They work hand in hand with local sheriff's offices and other enforcement agencies as well on issues that are cross jurisdictional. For the first time in many years, probably about 20 years, we're going to achieve a full complement of conservation officers, which is about 215 field stations. With attrition and retirements and things like that, it's taken us a while to get there, but for the first time in many years, we're going to achieve that goal, and we need to continue dealing with that attrition as retirements come up. But it's having that full complement will allow us to keep in check the activities that are out there and make sure that the work that we do and the opportunities we all enjoy remain. Division of Forestry, I know you've talked with Director Epperly about their core functions. Our core function overall, if somebody asked me what the number one function of the DNR was or what we thought our number one duty is to protect the state and the residents of property from fire. That's why the open appropriation on fire and protection of fire, natural resources, property, and lives is the number one activity. It may not often seem that way with some of the issues you talk about, but when there is a fire or during fire season, it changes the way the organization operates because we take staff from many divisions or we have people that are trained firefighters. They get on the ground, they're gone, they're mobilized. Also, Senator Saxog has a unique privilege to house the what we call MIFCE, Minnesota Interagency Fire Center, which is a federal fire cache of materials, knowledge, and technology that we dispatch throughout the upper Midwest and throughout the country, actually, when a fire arises. Colorado fire, fires in Alaska. The planes, the CL-215 firefighting planes that we bought several years ago and are now paid for, we dispatch and are used throughout the nation. That's how we're able to pay for them, by renting them out, kind of. But when we need them, we call them back right away. It's that kind of opportunity that we have with our stakeholders nationally that helps us become a leader or maintain a leadership role in firefighting. Division of Waters maintaining. I'm sorry.
Mr. Meyer, on the enforcement function on the safety training education, the DNR does training on safety classes for ATVs. I learned that at least Articat and I think Polaris all offer free training for that safety class. They offer free tuition, or they pay for the safety class for anyone who buys an ATV. Is that offer from them utilized as much as it could or should be?
Mr. Chair, members, I need to check into that. I will find out, see if we can track that information. I know several of the manual, I think Polaris and Articat, in order for your warranty to become activated, you have to take a safety orientation program at the dealership. Mm-hmm. So I can see if we have an ability to track that or how we should be able to find that out for you.
Yeah.
I'll get back to you on that.
Yeah. It's my understanding that they pay for that certificate training.
There's a $15 fee which covers our training costs and then the administration of the program. And I think by the tracking of that payment, I can figure out how many people are participating.
And then related question, how much does the DNR publicize that fact, if at all? Is it mentioned anywhere?
Mr. Chair, those are good questions, and I will provide the committee with that information.
Okay, thank you.
Moving on to waters on slide 23.
Well, did you do forestry already?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Well, I talked about fire. I thought some of that previously has been covered, but okay. We have 4.5 million acres of state forest land in the state that we manage for multiple use purposes. Economic impact is a big part of that. That's where we do all of our state forest timber harvesting. working with landowners and communities to restore and protect their forests, helping them plan on how to utilize and maintain their forests, their tree stands. We also spend a lot of activity producing tree seedlings for conservation planting. You'll see on Arbor Day. We work in conjunction with the private manufacturers, private nurseries, so we aren't over-competing with each other. We buy a lot of our tree seedlings from private growers, nurseries. It's very important to keep that relationship and that trust level there as well. So we work with local nurseries. And also the Sustainable Forests Resource Act, implementing the powers and duties that are in Chapter 89 it's a progressive statute that was written about 10 years ago, provides us the ability to manage and protect and educate the users of our forests and the harvesters in sustainable ways. You'll see a bill here in a couple of days in committee that we will be trying to remove. This chapter of law is set to be repealed this year. We need to remove the repealer so that we don't lose these protections and programs that are offered in this chapter of law. So we'll spend more time talking about that actually tomorrow night in the forestry subcommittee.
Does this include the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, the SFIA?
The SFIA.
Is that within this act, or is that a separate act?
Mr. Chair, it's related to some of the activities in this act. It's also in, I believe, Chapter 296, maybe, the Department of Revenue.
290C.
Sorry. Okay. I don't deal with those chapters too much.
We had heard some concerns last week about the SFIA Sustainable Forest Incentives Act. Is the DNR underway in reviewing that act and looking at any reforms?
Mr. Chair, members, we are working with the stakeholders involved in that reform and trying to make sure our concerns are addressed, which basically are just the way the program is administered and making sure that it's fair and equitable for all landowners and people who participate.
When do you think you'll come up with something?
I can check, Mr. Chair, and get back to you. I need to talk with Director Epperly and Tomlinson. We should be able to have some brief discussion on that tomorrow in the Forestry Subcommittee.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going on to waters. The Division of Waters, their core function is to maintain the physical integrity of Minnesota water, I should say. Public waters protection, public waters works permits when someone needs to do or wishes to do some work in or around a public waters, a permit is needed. We also work with water supply as we dealt with the drought issues last summer. Our drought management planning team was kind of housed out of Division of Waters. We met weekly talking about what needed to be done and working with those water appropriation permit holders to make sure that they knew the impacts and where we had to, as aquifers reached dangerous levels, shutting down or temporarily shutting down the allowable uses out of those aquifers. Sod farms, some golf courses were impacted this past year. So you may hear about that, especially if it's in your district. I'm sure you'll hear about those issues. But it's those kinds of things that the Division of Waters works with. And also, a large part of their duties deal with the technical services to support the decision-making for the state and local governments as they look at their planning, their ordinances. I know the committee is going to hear about shoreline ordinances next week. Division of Waters is heavily involved, and we'll be discussing these issues with you as well. Working with those local units of government to protect the resources that we have is a big function of the Division of Waters.
You talk about nearly 10 million acres of wetlands. Is there a firm definition of wetland when you come up with this number?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that when we talk about that number, it comes from the public water inventory, probably. Working with Bowser, I see Kevin Lyons over there. It's pretty close, I think. Most of the works that we do are waters listed within that public waters inventory, which is a survey that was done many years ago. I want to say the 70s, I believe, to create a list of actual public waters. Those are our core responsibilities. I can find out more information on that number for you, Mr. Chair.
And there's a new inventory process going on now. Is that correct? Mr. Lyons, you want to come up?
Sorry, Kevin.
You don't have to. It's just an invitation.
I appreciate the invitation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, and I think the 10 million acres...
If you wouldn't mind introducing yourself. Thank you.
Kevin Lyons, I'm the conservation easement manager for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. The 10 million acre figure, I think, would be a figure that would be defined under definition of the Warden classification system in Minnesota. That would cover all wetlands types from types 1, and it's a fairly complicated system, but on up to peatlands, and so it's a very scientific derived number in Minnesota. As far as we are, when I say we, in partnership with the Department of Natural Resources, the Pollution Control Agency, are developing and in the process of developing a new inventory system for the state of Minnesota. And just really beginning to get underway with that, working with state agencies involved in developing a formal monitoring and inventorying system for the state so we can get a better tracking, not only what's present, but what the losses the state is experiencing, and then deal with those. We're also in the process, a cooperative effort to look at Minnesota's wetland restoration strategic plan. We're just getting underway with that as well. Be looking at stakeholders' involvement in that process as well to put together a statewide strategic plan for wetland restoration for the state. And so that also, I think, will be very helpful.
So when there is a wetland mitigation under the no net loss rule, are those wetlands that are created counted amongst this 10 million wetlands that are part of a mitigation?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm not 100% sure of how we would track that number. Typically, we do not count mitigation acres as far as our regular wetland resource base. It would be a separate category that would be tracked.
Okay.
You know, it's a regulatory function of the Wetland Conservation Act, looking at wetland impacted acres and then mitigation plans or replacement acres at a higher scale. And so that would also be part of that monitoring and inventorying system that we have been working on, the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I'm not the person personally responsible for the Wetland Conservation Act for the agency, but we've been in a year-long process of reviewing and looking at the Wetland Conservation Act and has been making some recommendations for how we can improve that.
Because we learned in this committee that a wetland that has been mitigated does not necessarily translate into something similar. We had the Walmart example where there was a wetland, they mitigated, and the resulting wetland was a concrete pond with what looked like a boat ramp going into it. So that's why I'm wondering if those are counted as an acre of wetland when we are counting. It sounds like we need to delve into that a little bit more, and I didn't want to get into too much into this today, but I was just curious as to how that 10 million acres was counted. Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am just trying to be clear about what DNR's role is in looking out for water quality issues compared to how it relates to the PCA. And I guess what I'm getting at is it seems as though the DNR, you're just responsible for the actual how much water there is and making sure that the levels are somewhat stable, or you track that, but you don't, or correct me if I'm wrong, you don't track, for instance, pollution or impacts on public water supply by, polluted sources or whatever is polluting the waters. Is that correct?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stephen, to a certain degree, we work tracking stream flow monitoring. You'll see as part of our Clean Water Legacy budget proposals to make sure we have stream flow gauges in all of our 81 major watersheds throughout the state. Looking at the actual sources, however, is something that our sister agency, the Pollution Control Agency, does. We work very closely with PCA, Bowser, Department of Ag, on water quality and water impairment issues. The sources of pollution are typically tracked by the Pollution Control Agency. Once the waters become polluted, we try to work with landowners about restoration activities, trying to work to maintain with those water systems, but the actual cleanup of polluted bodies of water doesn't fall within our jurisdiction.
Can you speak to your DNR's specific involvement in this 3M issue that's come up recently?
Senator Chaudhry, members, we have not been directly involved in that issue. That is something that Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health is working on. The Pollution Control Agency did assess some fish populations. I don't have that data with me, but I know that they've been working on that. Where we would be come into play on something like that is publicizing the health impacts, if there were any identified, from fish consumption, things of that nature. The actual groundwater, we look at kind of quantity and quality of the waters that are out there when we appropriate waters. We don't have any authority under statute to go after people who are polluting waters or who are causing those impacts. Those are all found in the Pollution Control Agency's authorities.
I'm just looking at the bullet point, public waters protection by regulating activities through permitting, land use controls, and grant programs. Wasn't the DNR involved in any permitting or land use controls with regards to 3M?
Mr. Chair, members, and this is not an area of my expertise, so bear with me. The sources of those contaminations were from a closed landfill, which the Pollution Control Agency has responsibilities over. Our authorities here in this bullet, talking about regulating activities to permitting, land use controls, and grant programs. The permitting deals with public waters works permits, constructing in and around waters for a house or a business or people who need to dredge a canal, things of that nature, putting in beach or sand blankets on somebody's beach. Construction activities related to the riparian surfaces of where the land and the water come into connection. Our land use controls function on those as well, and then we deal with the appropriation of waters for industry and businesses and agricultural uses.
All right. Maybe at some point we want to hear from the waters folks a little more detail on that. But are the fish and wildlife people involved at all in the fish testing and all of that? We hear about some of these endocrine disruptors that are in the Mississippi River that are affecting fish. To what extent has the DNR been involved with studying the broader issue and then the specific event with 3M?
Mr. Chair, members, most of our testing activities, as I said, the 3M situation, we have not been directly involved in that. There has been fish testing done by the Pollution Control Agency. As far as endocrine disruptor issues, our testing for fish right now deals with mercury and fish consumption issues related to the deposition of mercury in our waters. So we have a statewide fish consumption recommendation right now. We do not have any work going on dealing with endocrine disruptors or the testing of fish at this point in time for endocrine disruptors. We are trying to figure out what should be done at that level, and it's something that we need to discuss with Ecological Services at more depth, and I don't have that information with me right now.
Did the PCA share their fish testing information with the DNR?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that information was shared with Ecological Services. To the extent that we have done anything with it, we have not done anything with the information yet. It's an ongoing issue that is still being developed. It's really an issue that the Pollution Control Agency and Department of Health are focusing on.
Okay. Senator Dibble, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, we can defer this. I was just wondering why Senator Stephen was so interested in this. I'm just kidding. We did have DNR quite involved in, you know, surface water issues in Minneapolis when we had flooding concerns and some concerns with water quality when it was non-point. And they mixed their money in quite readily with the local watershed district and others to do some significant water quality enhancement projects. That was a big help. So I know they get involved in some of that surface water, non-point source water quality improvement work.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like a landfill is a non-point source.
And
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, I brought it up, and just so committee members are aware, this whole perfluorinated chemical issue is really important to my district. For those of you who don't know, there's now they and the Department of Health and the PCA have certainly been working on this, but it's commonly thought that these perfluorinated chemicals are in the Jordan Aquifer and effectively, you know, contaminating the water of, you know, the entire South Washington County metropolitan area. Now there's debate about how, you know, what degree it's a contaminant and some of the health concerns over the particular contaminant in the water, but it's certainly an issue of concern and stuff that I hope will the committee will take more. I appreciate your interest in this, and as we sort of figure out what to do here, I would appreciate the committee's indulgence on the subject because it is a really big issue of concern in my area.
Okay. Anything else, members?
Mr. Meyer, Mr. Chair, members, Kent Lacrosse from our Division of Waters will be in front of the committee on Monday, I believe, talking about shoreline issues. So you can ask him some of those other specific questions you may have for Waters as well at that point in time.
Okay.
Just quickly moving on, I talked about operations support a little bit.
Mr. Meyer, one can of worms per committee meeting.
Mr. Chair, I wish I could just stick to that. I have a lot of worms that I walk around with. Just quickly, operations support. We talked about the core functions provided here. Commissioner's Office, Management Budget Services, Human Resources, Management Resources, Information Education, and Regional Operations. This division or the Bureau helps coordinate all of our activities as a department, make sure that we can get the work done that we need to. And just to summarize, the summary of the big change drivers, the big drivers of change on slide 25, habitat loss and fragmentation, clean water and sustainable use, public access to natural resources, harmful invasive species, the changing forest products industry we're dealing with, OHV use, management regulation, changing recreation participation, global climate change, and then the promising area of biofuels development and what that holds in store for our lands, our land ownership, and also the state's land ownership, how we can utilize some of our lands as actual production sources for biofuels. It will really be promising for not only conservation, but also for energy production in the state. The last slide here, the interconnected resources, integrated solutions, I really just want you to think of it. I have this picture that hangs on my office wall. It really, to me, shows how everything's connected. Forest cover is, you know, timber and rough grouse and wildlife viewing, fishing, trout, healthy rivers. Everything that we do as a state, as people out there enjoying our resources, are connected. As we manage our forests for timber, it provides better opportunities for rough grouse, deer, other wildlife, which increases our ability for wildlife viewing, our uses of the outdoors. Also, proper forest management contributes directly to river health, which applies to our trout, our fisheries, which relates to improved fishing opportunities. So everything is connected, as you all well know. And this is just kind of one of my favorite diagrams that I have out there to kind of show that. And again, the last slide, focusing on results. We are vision and mission driven. We take fund integrity very important. Operations with integrated resource management, adaptive management. We're always dealing with those types of changing issues that we have out there. And we have performance indicators that we've been tracking through our strategic conservation agenda. That shows some of our progress and shows where we aren't making progress as well. So I encourage you to utilize that as a report card for us, so to speak. With that, Mr. Chair, I really thank you for all the time you've given me. I did not intend to spend this much time, but I think it's been a learning opportunity for me as well. So,
I think for the members that are on the finance division, it's valuable to reinforce this information.
Senator Bickerman?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know if you're going to talk about it now or not, but You know, I'm very concerned about killing all the deer in northern Minnesota. You know I am. I picked up a couple magazines. I gave one to the chair.
Yes, I go up there.
Not everybody is happy with the slaughter of deer in those counties. So I want you to be aware that what might take place tomorrow in the Ag Committee, because I know the bill's there, there could be an amendment come and say if deer are that important, wildlife, DNR, is going to have to help with our TB inoculation and our part of it. Deer are that important, then you ought to be able to share some of your money instead of taking all the money out of the Ag Division to take care of the TV. So be aware of that. Share and share alike, if that's that important, and I think that's... I want to get rid of them, too, but I don't think we should put all the... take all the money out of the Ag Department, and I'm trying to do other things, and DNR evidently made the decision to shoot the deer up there. I think it was you. Maybe it wasn't. Whoever made that decision...
Just to protect your egg from the animals.
I'm going to...
take the herd.
See if... and all the money that DNR's got, if you could help...
and the ag herds, too.
Help with that plan, and because we're going to run out of money in my ag committee, too.
Mr. Chair, Senator Vickerman, thank you, and we will meet with you beforehand to talk about those issues. And sounds like you're warming up for Ed to get up here.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, I was kind of interested in hearing a little bit more about what Senator Vickerman is talking about here, just for information purposes. Are you saying that if we get you more TB vaccines than on your farms, then you won't need to shoot as many deer?
No.
Is that what you're suggesting?
No.
Am I getting that wrong?
Mr. Chair.
The deer are infected, too. So
Senator Anderson.
Maybe explain a little bit.
Senator Vickerman, our deer got it from your cows.
If it's that important for the DNR, you can go and kill those deer off to stop that spread, then you ought to be willing to help. But the other part of that, there's two parts. There's the deer shooting, but there's also we have to take care of TB, and that's going to take a big chunk of money, and I'm willing to do that because I don't want it to spread all over. I'm just saying if it's – I think the DNR should at least – help us. If they say the deer are out there worrying about spreading it, why shouldn't they be part of the solution?
By way of background for the members who are not familiar with it, there's a disease called bovine tuberculosis, and a lot of cows have been getting it in Minnesota. And the way you deal with it is you have to exterminate the entire herd of cattle. Problem is that it's also contagious to other animals, and that bovine tuberculosis has been discovered in deer in the in a particular herd of deer in the Rosso area. Is that correct?
Yep. Rosso Sky, Mr. Chairman. Yes.
But it's been concentrated. That discovery has been concentrated within this small area. And the decision has been made that all of those, just like the cattle, the deer have in this area have to be eliminated as well in this six-mile area. And so the question Senator Vickerman has is who covers the cost of doing that?
So, Mr. Chairman, who got it from whom?
Well, our deer got it from his cows.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. Yes. But
then, Mr. Chair, yeah, the deer has to be after egg for some help in getting rid of those deer.
Right. Now here's what I thought I had learned this past weekend. Isn't the U.S. Department putting a lot of this effort?
Mr. Chair and members, you summarized it very well. This is very much a cooperative effort with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the State Department of Agriculture, the State Board of Animal Health, and the DNR, and we're all concerned about bovine tuberculosis and reestablishing Minnesota's livestock bovine tuberculosis-free status. And so We've developed a plan, Board of Animal Health and Department of Ag have developed a plan to do what we can to eradicate TB in cattle and in deer. There's only one other area in the United States that has bovine TB self-sustaining in deer. We're hoping that we don't become the second, but that other state is Michigan, and they've had an infection, a self-sustaining infection of TB in deer for 20 years or so at least, and it's beyond their ability to control it at this point. They're just trying to reduce the incidence, and so it's permanently affecting their livestock industry because they can never regain their totally TB-free status as long as it's in the deer. A year ago, we found two positive deer in direct association with those positive cattle farms that have since been depopulated of cattle. Everything at that time was consistent with a cattle disease spilling over into deer. The strain of the TB, there are different strains. The Michigan strain is actually called the Michigan strain. The strain that's been identified by the DNA in Minnesota is the Mexican strain, which has been found in cattle in various areas of the southwestern United States and Mexico, which further points to cattle as being the source and deer as being the secondary infection. At that time, we did not believe we had a deer disease. We thought we had some deer that had been infected by cattle, so we did not feel we needed to take extraordinary measures to control deer. This year, we did much more testing. In fact, we did statewide testing that was required by the U.S. Department of Agriculture that the deer be tested statewide as part of our plan to get our TB status back. We did that testing. We did intensive testing up in that Roseau-Skyme area, and we don't have final results back from the National Veterinary Services Lab in Ames, Iowa yet, but we have presumptive positives, which are like 99% certain of at least five deer this year, and that has raised our level of concern significantly. They're still all associated, as you said, Mr. Chairman, right with those areas where those cattle farms were. It still may be spillover, but if it's an ember of TB that's getting ready to fan into a forest fire of TB throughout our northern Minnesota deer herd, we think it's prudent to stamp out that ember right in that 6 mile diameter area as quickly as we can. So we are contracting with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Wildlife Services, to who have specialists who do deer removal in urban areas and park areas and have specialized equipment to do this very efficiently, safely, and effectively. They operate at night, and they can remove a lot of deer in a very short period of time in a very safe manner. And we're holding a meeting up there, a public meeting tomorrow night, because there has been concern from some of the local deer hunters and some of the local people who feed deer in that area. We prohibited deer feeding in that area as required by a law that was passed by the legislature last year to try to address the nose-to-nose contact of not only deer but cattle. And it's something we're taking very seriously. We'd be happy, Senator Vickerman, to meet with you. Unfortunately, tomorrow, most of our people most directly involved with this are going to be up at Winoska at our public meeting. But, you know, I'm familiar with the basics of what we're doing, and we're going to have folks up there tomorrow from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the State Department of Agriculture, the State Board of Animal Health, the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, the Minnesota Cattlemen's Association, all speaking in support of the action that we're taking. We understand that we have some local landowners who've been raising the deer, feeding the deer, managing for large deer that are not very happy, and we absolutely will not go on any private property without written authorization from the private landowner. We're meeting, knocking on doors, meeting with landowners. we're going to have another meeting with some landowners before the meeting tomorrow night to try to allay some of their concerns. And so we recognize it's creating some short-term sacrifice, and we regret that, but we think it's for the overall good of our deer herd and our cattle industry in the state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
I understand if you're going to be up there. That's fine. But I tell you what I will do. I will hold I'll hold my decision until I hear from you later, because I can always do it.
Sure.
Just in fairness issue, because I don't want that disease to get down in the southern part of the state. I certainly don't want to do that. All I'm just desperately trying to find money. And that's what the name of the game here is, money. And so I will give you my word. I won't put it on there tomorrow, but I want to visit with you.
Sure.
Later on when you have your crew here so we get on the right track.
Mr. Baucus, are the costs being shared?
Mr. Chair, and Senator Vickerman, that was the point I wanted to make, is that we have successfully sought some federal funding and also some general funding previously, and we're working with the governor's office right now to seek some more general fund in the governor's budget to address this issue, because we don't feel it's appropriate that just the deer hunters pay for it either, given the likely source and the impacts. And we have gotten money through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, some federal money, and we also last session got some general fund money through the governor's supplemental budget. So we're more than willing to try to help find money that's not currently within your purview if we can help support that.
This appears to be a necessary move, but it's still a shock.
Yes.
when particularly people up there minding their own business, and suddenly this happens. So I appreciate the approach of kind of talking to people first. But I guess the other side of the coin is, what do you do if someone says no, and they've got these deer, these deer are in that, potentially on their property. What do you do if they say no?
Mr. Chair and members, we're pretty sure we're going to encounter some of that this year. This isn't going to be just a one-shot thing, unfortunately. We're going to have to be monitoring for several years, and we're going to follow up. A lot of what we're hearing is, let us do it through hunting. Let us do the shooting through hunting. We're certainly going to have expanded hunting opportunity in terms of additional seasons, throw out the limit, perhaps some reduced cost or free extra tags, early and late hunts, things like that. So we're going to follow through with more opportunity in the fall for hunters. We'll also offer landowner shooting permits for shooting deer on their own property. And we're hearing that some of those things might be viewed a little more favorably by some of those landowners. Also, we have a fairly good interspersion of public and private land. So if we have landowners that absolutely refuse to cooperate, we may be able to lure those deer across the road, get them there. Mr. Chair and members, just so you know, we will be using bait, because this is not a hunt. This is a deer depopulation in a small targeted area, and just so you know too, no one really knows how to totally eliminate deer across a large landscape area. We will not be successful in eliminating every deer there. The deer will rapidly fill back in because they disperse long distances, and we're only concentrating on a small core area. Our objective is to get all the positive deer and hope that they're not already transmitting it between each other. It's a slow-acting infection. They can live 6-8 years with this disease. So we still may be seeing deer that were originally infected from those cattle 3-4 years ago.
And this is not a fun little private hunt for some people. I met some people up there this weekend that said that they were part of it for another situation some time ago, and they just stopped because it just kind of made them sick to have to do all that.
Mr. Chair, we did issue some landowner permits last year for those that were interested, that were either on the cattle farms that were infected or fence line to those farms, and we had a couple of individuals who volunteered as shooters, and it went from fun to work pretty quickly.
Senator Olson, you had your hand up.
Mr. Chairman, you asked my question. But I could ask one more. Is the meat of the deer usable, or does it have to be destroyed?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, the meat is fine, and the likelihood of infected animals is low. It's a bacterial infection, so thorough cook. It needs to be well cooked, and then it's fine to eat. So, you know, the usual precautions: wear gloves when you're dressing it, cook the meat thoroughly. It's fine to eat. In the advanced stages, there are obvious lesions in the deer. If we see those deer will not be processed for human consumption. But the deer that appear healthy will be made available for donation to people that want the meat. And we'll just alert them on safe handling and cooking.
And, Mr. Chairman, will you be testing all of the deer that you take?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, will test every deer, even if it looks healthy.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know you were kind of joking when you were talking about how it gets transmitted, but seriously, does anybody know? I mean, are the deer and cattle, are they consorting? Are they socializing?
Always.
Are they, like, it's wild animals. I mean, how does this happen? Does anyone have any idea how it's been spread?
There's a little bit of that consorting going on, but it's probably more than likely it's being transferred through feeding. Mm-hmm. They come in close contact with each other's feeders, mm-hmm. and then these
deer come on the farm.
Yeah, sure. But then it's exacerbated by these folks who have their own feeding stations on their own land to attract deer.
The deer. Mm-hmm.
So then you get a herd of deer all together on this little bin full of corn, and they're all touching noses and breathing on each other and transferring saliva. Yeah, and then they don't wash their hooves. So then it spreads. Yeah. And a parasol.
Mr. Chairman, just a question to Mr. Bogus, since you're a biologist. I'm assuming that that typically, because TB is a consumptive kind of disease, that it doesn't travel throughout all the organs and the muscles of the body, even in deer. I mean, for humans, typically, it's mostly consumptive.
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Parasol, it's where you see the lesions is in the lymph nodes and in the body cavity. You don't really see it in the meat. Mm-hmm. But because in the lymph system, there's potential for the bacteria to be, you know, if you're cutting up the meat and you cut yourself, you know, it's potential for getting a bacterial, a skin type. It's not really the disease, but you can get kind of a skin infection from it. But it really isn't a major concern for the deer population, because it's so slow acting that the deer, by the time it really affects their health, they're older than most deer live anyway. So it's more of a human health and livestock issue than it is a deer population issue. It's not going to wipe out the deer, but it creates other problems that we are concerned about, even beyond deer management. So that's why we're taking it so seriously.
Thank you.
We should wrap up this discussion. We want you to continue on with your presentation, and then we want to leave plenty of time for roadsides and Blue Earth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to just go through this real quickly. I know a lot of you been around and are familiar with the Division of Fish and Wildlife, but for the new members and just as a refresher for the rest of you, I'll highlight a few things about our division. We'll have myself and others probably before this committee quite a bit, and there's also a copy of this in your packets, I believe, but I'm going to just go through it quickly and highlight a few things, and then if you see things that you want to talk about in more detail, we can do that, but rather than spend a lot of time, because I know you've got other things you want to get through. Mr. Meyer already talked about the mission of the department. Our mission is nested within that, more focused on fisheries and wildlife populations and management. Our division contains three primary functions: fisheries management, wildlife management, and then we also have all the licensing for the Department of Natural Resources we manage within our division. Just to give you a flavor of the scope of the licensing, It deals with not all, only all of the hunting and fishing licenses, but registration of snowmobiles and OHVs and ski passes and boats and commercial licenses and all that. So, and this is now done almost exclusively through our electronic licensing system. So we manage the agents at about 1,700 or 1,800 locations throughout the state. We are a large division within the DNR, within the eight divisions in the DNR. We have, if you count all of our full and part-time and seasonal and temporary staff, about 656 full-time equivalents. We have 66 offices, fisheries and wildlife offices around the state. We manage about 1.2 million acres of wildlife management areas, and then we have an aquatic management area system that's growing that deals with shorelines and streams and protecting fish spawning areas, and these areas are also generally open to other outdoor activities. You can see the other information on the number of fishing lakes and streams and game species and so forth. We have about 1.5 million licensed anglers and another 600,000 or so non-licensed youth and others that are exempt from licenses. We have about 578,000 individuals who are licensed hunters and trappers. About 2.2 million people view wildlife in Minnesota in the last survey that was done about 5 years ago. Funding is primarily from the dedicated funds, as Mr. Meyer talked about, the Game and Fish Fund, plus the dedicated accounts, which are the stamps and surcharges, total about three-quarters of our budget. The heritage enhancement is that in lieu of tax on the lottery tickets that Mr. Meyer talked about, that's also in the Game and Fish Fund. The general fund is only 3% of our budget. So we're heavily dependent on hunting and fishing license revenues and then the federal excise taxes on hunting and fishing equipment that come back to us through the Pittman-Robertson and Dingell-Johnson-Wallet Bro programs, where it's matching reimbursement for our expenditures. Go quickly through fisheries. Four primary services: monitoring and applied research on fish populations and habitats, conserving, and I'm going to go through each one of these in a little bit more detail, but conserving, improving, and restoring fish populations and aquatic habitats, propagating fish for stocking in waters that have public access, and providing opportunities for conservation partnerships, information education, and recruitment and retention. Under the category of monitoring and applied research, we do extensive inventory of resources. We work, we have a large lakes database that is very highly utilized. Anglers and others interested in the results of our test netting and other surveys on lakes. We've been doing more work with the University of Minnesota and with our electronic licensing system in trying to identify some of the preferences of anglers and what they're looking for in their angling experiences. Now we've been dealing with the issue of fish rearing in wetlands and some of the conflicts between stocking fish, raising bait, and producing high-quality habitat for waterfowl, and those aren't always all compatible activities in our wetlands. In fact, they're often not compatible. Under conserving, improving, and restoring populations and habitat, I mentioned aquatic management area acquisition and easement. This is part of the outdoor recreation system. These are shoreline or stream easements or acquisitions. Got a lot of trout stream easements in the state. We also are acquiring more shoreland and other areas to protect their values for fish habitat and water quality. And we've got a citizens committee that's looking at this aquatic management area program to make recommendations on where they see this program perhaps going over the next 50 years, similar to what we had done a few years ago with our wildlife management area system. You can see some of the other activities there. Our large lake management program is We've got 10 large lakes plus Lake Superior. These are lakes like Mille Lacs and Red Lake and Leech Lake and Lake of the Woods, where we have staff that intensively monitor and evaluate the fisheries and forage conditions on those lakes and do modeling for development of regulations to maintain strong year classes of fish. Under the category of stocking, this is a summary of the fiscal year 2006, which ended last June. Accomplishments, see the amount of fry fingerlings that were stocked for walleye. Now we also do smaller stocking of muskie. The primary stocking is walleye and trout. We also do some muskie, a little bit of northern, and then we do quite a bit, particularly here in the metro area, of kids fishing ponds, where we'll put fish in to help out with some of our education programs. We've got a Minocqua program, which is a statewide program to help teach kids about the connection between fish and water and lake quality, and also about fishing and how you go about fishing to get them more connected with our water and fisheries resources. We also, the FIN is the Fishing in the Neighborhoods program, where we, near schools, will identify water bodies where we can place catchable fish for people that can't make it to a more difficult or farther out or stream, where they can go and have the experience of catching fish. We're doing a lot more work. We've had a fisheries roundtable since the early 1990s. It was combined several years ago to include ecological services and wildlife, and that's an ongoing roundtable. It's held every year, usually the first week or so in January, to get the various stakeholder groups together. But now we're starting some species workshops to do some more detail work on what anglers are looking for, and we've divided it up into esocids, or kind of the northern muskie group, walleyes, bass, and we're having those groups do some work in the meantime between the roundtables to come in with recommendations on regulations or habitat or things like that. The only other one here I would mention is the oversight committees for our dedicated accounts. Trout and Salmon Stamp has a dedicated account and oversight committee, and then there's a Fisheries Operations Citizens Oversight Committee. And Mr. Meyer talked earlier, there's also just an overall Game and Fish Committee, and the wildlife side, there's a committee, subcommittee, they're actually called for every dedicated account, whether it's the deer accounts, the duck stamp account, pheasant stamp account. So we do reports, and they review expenditures and make recommendations on an annual basis. This just gives you a breakdown of the fisheries funding within the division, and they're even more dependent on the Game and Fish Fund account. Get very, very little general fund fisheries budget. Some of the critical challenges facing fisheries, size and numbers of fish, quality of fish is always an issue, and we have tremendous fishing resources in the state, but there's also a lot of pressure. We have lots of anglers, as I mentioned earlier, so getting more and more efficient with their information, their technology, their understanding of where and how to catch fish. So this is a constant challenge. And then you throw the technological advancements on it, it's even more of a challenge. We do a lot of inventory of fish and forage and invasive species and habitat conditions. We provide a large database of information that's available to the public. And we're looking more and more at long-term monitoring. We've got some long-term monitoring data, but as some of the climate issues become more to the forefront, we're looking at more long-term monitoring so we can better assess where we've been and where we're headed. Habitat degradation and loss, I think everybody's aware of the pressures on our shorelines, and it's people develop those shorelines, they often make changes that are not beneficial to the quality of the habitat on those shorelines. And, we're losing a lot of the plants in the littoral areas of the lakes, and there's water quality issues, and any one development of a house doesn't have a huge effect, but when you start adding them all up, the cumulative impact can be very devastating to some of our lakes and streams. In the access, part of the federal funding that we get, 15% of the fisheries federal aid funds that come in are dedicated to public access and go to our Trails and Waterways Division. We're also doing more work with accessible fishing areas, trying to make those more available across the state. Then one of the things that we're sensitive to is the simplifying regulations and not having the complexity of the regulations be a barrier. We've tried to tailor the regulations to the populations and composition of species lake by lake, and then and adjust them as necessary. But that does lead to many, many different sets of regulations on different lakes. And so we're working where we can to try to simplify, make the regulations understandable so that people aren't intimidated from trying fishing just by the complexity of the regulations. Fish health and invasive species are a constant challenge, not only for the health of the fishery, but also for the work that we're doing as we're working in these various bodies of water and going from one to another.
Excuse me, Mr. Bogus, Senator Dill. Or Senator Dibble.
It's okay.
Excuse me.
Our mail gets interchanged all the time. We're always having to ship it back and forth. Yeah, on this subject, which tends to get my attention as the committee probably has noticed, is there a big meeting tonight up in Duluth or tomorrow night up in Duluth about a new virus now that we're experiencing in the Duluth and Sperry Harbors?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I'm not familiar with the specific meeting, but this the what's termed VHS here is not, you know, it's not the tape that you put in the in the video player. It's a viral hemorrhagic septicemia is a disease that newly discovered in the Great Lakes. It's primarily in bass, but can also affect trout. The U.S. Department of Agriculture Veterinary Services promulgated a rule recently prohibiting movement of fish because of fear of spreading this disease, and it was initially a blanket rule that stopped our aquaculture people from moving any of their fish out of the state. They've since amended that and eased up a little bit, but it still covers the Lake Superior watershed. It's been found in Lake Huron. It's within 40 miles of Lake Superior, and it's inevitable that it will be found in Lake Superior, and it's going to create problems for the fish populations in the lake, and also for any movement of fish or bait, rearing of fish in hatcheries in Lake Superior, and moving them. We're gonna have to change how we do business, and so that we don't start transferring this disease into inland waters. So it's a very significant new disease that's heading for Lake Superior. And that's probably, I'm not familiar with the specific meeting you're referencing, yeah, but I'm guessing that's what it is.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think this is yet another thing that came in via ballast water. Is that correct? And do you know what exactly does it do to the fish, and what happens when it's introduced into a population? How devastating is it? And, I mean, is it at all feasible? So three questions. Is it at all feasible to keep it from the inland waters? I haven't seen anything yet that's come into the Great Lakes that we've kept out of the inland waters other than maybe lamprey.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I'm not a real expert on this disease. I know it kills fish that get it. It doesn't kill all the fish. As far as whether it's feasible to keep it out of the inland waters, That's a good question. We've with all these invasive species or diseases, we've found that it's we can slow them down, but it's so far we haven't found a way to stop them. As long as people are moving, if they're in a connected drainage, it's going to be virtually impossible. If they're not in a connected drainage, then it becomes people going from one body of water to another. Mm-hmm. We haven't been to the point where we want to stop people from going from one body of water to another, because it kind of defeats the purpose of, you know, the resources that we have, mm-hmm. that we all want to be able to enjoy in the state. So short of some draconian measures, it may be difficult, although, you know, this one's kind of working its way upstream, so to speak. So if we can contain it within watersheds, we may be able to keep it from jumping into other watersheds.
Mr. Bogus.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to move along and try to get through some of the wildlife things also. But just quickly on recruitment retention, participation in all the outdoor, what they call nature-based activities, have been showing declines not only in Minnesota but across the country. Minnesota has actually been holding up as well or better than most of the other states. But one of our issues is declining angler participation. This will have fiscal implications in the future. As you know, I mentioned earlier, much of our funding for our conservation programs is based on revenue from license sales, and points out the need for other sources of funding, you know, beyond just the traditional sources. And I know there's been a lot of discussion in this committee and in the legislature over the last few years on other ways to fund conservation.
Mr. Bogus, Senator Pariseau.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bogus, one of the things that we heard it last week, and it had to do with the apprentice angler, I believe. And that came from department, if I'm not mistaken, is that, or was it apprentice hunter? I can't recall which. But I think it'll help to shore up some of those lag sales in certain age groups, because let's face it, if a youngster doesn't have an uncle, a brother, a dad, or a grandfather that takes them out the first few times, by the time he gets to school, they start hanging on the streets and they don't think about the outdoor activities anymore. So I think some of those proposals are very valuable in ensuring the future of our activities.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pariseau, yes, we will be in our Game and Fish Bill talking about an apprentice hunter proposal, and we are hopeful that those types of things will help to if not turn these things around, at least stop the decline. And we've got some internal issues, too, with we're seeing a lot of long-term expertise in the department with our aging workforce that's going to be retiring in the next 10 years. And our 25-year fisheries research manager, Jack Wingate's, retiring in about a month. And it's just the start of a wave of retirements. And so we're dealing with some internal issues, too, and how to make sure that we're capturing that institutional knowledge and expertise. And then climate change is something that we've been having some forums and discussion, and Dr. Don Pereira of our staff has been doing some analysis of the potential for climate change to affect forage fish like tuilby and walleye in Lake Pepin and some of those issues. We've got similar issues with moose and other species that touch on briefly in the wildlife side. Moving quickly through wildlife, we've got seven primary services: habitat acquisition and development, populations and season management, inventory and research, forest management, which is cooperative with forestry and ecological services, shallow lakes, wildlife health, which we spent a little bit of time on today, and then public information, hunter-trapper recruitment and retention. Wildlife management area system is one of the largest in the country. Pennsylvania, we believe, has a larger system, but we're not aware of any other state. We've really appreciated the support from the stakeholders and the legislature in the last two bonding bills, where we received unprecedented amounts of acquisition and development dollars for WMAs, and we're out of land right now for expanding this system and trying to at least partially reached the goals of the Citizens Committee that recommended that we accelerate this program for a 50-year period to reach some goals of fully developing the system. Population and season management, I think everyone's familiar with the hunting and trapping seasons and regulations. We do a lot of survey information, harvest and population surveys. We have over 25 population surveys that we coordinate. Other staff from other agencies, federal and state, also help with some of those.
What is that thing they're holding up this year?
Mr. Chairman, this is an otter. It's actually alive, but it's tranquilized. It's part of an otter research study where we were implanting the otter with a radio implanted radio. You can't put a collar on an otter because they just shrug it off, and they don't really have necks. So we have to implant the radios like you do with fish. But that's a good question because it's not obvious what's going on.
Just need a bigger photo, that's all.
Yeah. Forest management, we do a lot of work in the forested part of the state in cooperation with Forestry and Ecological Services on subsection forest plans to try to maintain a mix of different types and ages of forest to benefit a variety of wildlife. We need both young and old forests for different wildlife. A lot of the wildlife is associated, particularly grouse, with early successional stage, but we also need some older forests for deer wintering and other species that need those older trees with cavities and so forth in them. Shallow lakes has been a major focus. These are the things that are between the wetland and the deep water fishing lake. We've got a lot of shallow lakes in the state. This is where a lot of the tension comes in between some of the fish and some of the duck interests. We're also having a major focus on wetlands and grasslands, and this committee already had a working lands presentation. We'll also be talking in Senator Anderson's committee about an expanded prairie grassland initiative. We're doing a lot of work with water control structures. We got some bonding money for that. We're designating more wildlife lakes. Wildlife health, of course, we got into this in a big way with CWD 4 years or 5 years ago. We've done statewide monitoring, and we're still doing targeted monitoring for CWD. We did some additional CWD work this last fall down in the Montevideo area. Statewide TB testing and the targeted TB testing. We tested over 4,000 deer statewide for TB this past year, and over 1,000 up in the Roseau-Skyme area.
Mr. Bogus, we want to make sure we give some time to our out-of-town guests.
Sure.
Are there some key points you want to highlight the rest of your presentation?
Mr. Chair, some of these other points are similar for wildlife as they were for fisheries on the recruitment retention issue. Would just say maybe on the encroachment is something that we're looking at. Likely we'll be coming back next year. This is the issue of development near wildlife areas and local ordinances and so forth.
Yeah.
The rest of this, I think, are things that we've already touched on. So I can cut this short. Sure, I'll get an opportunity to be back here again.
Yeah, let's try and remember where you left off and pick it up. But I think, you know, these are all very good things we should be hearing.
I think, Mr. Chair, I've covered most of the high points that I intended to cover today. So appreciate your time.
Questions for Mr. Bogus? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Roadsides, folks. Appreciate your patience. I'm not sure if we're going to get enough time for you, and I want to make sure you have plenty of time. You're okay with coming back? Thank you.
I have a couple of large things here.
Great.
Donovan, you want to give them a hand?
Yeah. We'll have someone give you a hand up there.
We don't know when we're going to do the roadside.
And Mr. Shepherd had a hand in producing the History of the Land series that we saw. Mr. Shepherd, this committee has seen all five episodes in their entirety.
I have heard that, and I will tell you that we are basically over the moon over this, because when we started the project, Barbara Coffin and I, I remember the conversation saying, when we said, gee, wouldn't it be wonderful if the legislature could actually sit down and watch all of this stuff? And but we never thought it would really actually happen, and it did. And we've been high-fiving one another for so what you guys are doing is just terrific, and everything. I can say this because we're not coming to you for money. but everything we've heard about you guys is just
encouraging.
Yeah, really encouraging. Yeah, encouraging. And I just want to say that. And I also want to thank you, Chairman Chaudhry, and others for inviting us and bumping the vaunted DNR from.
It's also a personal pet project of mine as well. So we're...
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay. So this is significant.
Maybe we should come to you for money.
No.
Well, introduction here.
Yeah, my name is Paula Westmoreland, and I'm an ecologist. I've got a background in sustainable agriculture and ecology. Have been doing some work with Permaculture Research Institute, Cold Climate, and I also have a company, Ecological Gardens. Lance and I have been working on this project for a couple years now. So,
And I'm Lance Shepherd, and I'm a writer, an environmental writer, and I was a co-conceiver with Barbara Coffin of the Minnesota History of the Land series, and was the lead writer on it, and at least for those first four, and the narrator, and for all of them. And continuing to consult with Bell Museum Productions, which is what we kind of became, and we've got other projects that we hope were down the pipe.
I forgot to mention this when we were watching the series. The Bell Museum was kind of my de facto daycare center. My mom worked at the U.
Uh-huh.
She was working extra hours. She would often drop me and my brother off at the Bell Museum. Spent a lot of time there.
Cool. Yeah.
You are, and I as a kid too. And I have an 88-year-old aunt who still remembers her first encounter with the beaver on the second floor there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that exhibit is still up, which is really amazing. Any rate, in a way, this project is an outgrowth of the sort of the next logical step from History of the Land series. In that series, we I think did a pretty good, credible job, if I could say so, of presenting the enormous changes that the Minnesota landscapes have undergone, and the dilemmas that has produced, and I think we did a pretty good job of tracing those long roots of historical roots of that. We purposefully didn't go into solutions to problems beyond suggesting that in whatever. Do going forward that we look to what these landscapes were and how they functioned to sort of give us hints as to how we might deal with them in the future. And in the fifth show, we did kind of touch on that a little bit more with the with modern forestry and what DNR was doing, some of the cool things there. In this case, we're suggesting in a more specific way some solutions. The product, at least for the landscape in southern Minnesota, the project in this case is a book. It's a book of illustrated essays. It's an initiative to engage farmers and landowners in the greater Blue Earth River Basin to restore critical habitat and return some sense of or some manner of historical functionality to the ecological and hydrological regimes in that watershed, and for purposes the watershed we're talking about really is that great sort of heart-shaped region south of Mankato. It's the combined watersheds of the Wantanwan River to
the north, kind of coming down through the Wantanwan over to the west and then over to the east. So it's a lot of south central Minnesota and a little bit of the Iowa border coming across down here at the bottom. So
it's about 2.3 million acres of basically corn and soybeans, or most of it is, and one of the reasons we chose this watershed is because received wisdom is that there's really nothing down there anymore. It's been pushed to the outermost margins by corn and soybeans, and that's not true. There are building blocks here that can be used to rebuild the landscape. The book itself features lands of ecological significance that could be used to filter water, to purify nitrate, nitrogen coming off of those production fields, cut sedimentation, cut phosphorus, restore critical habitat for wildlife, reconnect now severed wildlife corridors, and in many cases, some cases, depends on where you are, can provide farmers and landowners with income. And I think you've heard something of that in past sessions. We see the book as a kind of advocacy piece, but also a vision document for what the landscape could be, what is grown and how it's grown on the landscape. Our collaborators in this are a cadre of NRCS agents, SWCD agents, scientists, third crop agriculturalists. It's their vision and their story as well. And most important, probably landowners, farmers who are actually out there experimenting with tillage and planting regimes and working with some of these quote marginal lands. There are some really imaginative people doing wonderful things down there, and this kind of gives them voice. We're working with two, I think, fabulous photographers. One is Chris Faust. You may know his work. He's a St. Paul photographer, does giant panorama landscapes. And Meg Ojala, who is a professor of photography down in Northfield, who works with natural images, and she has some really gorgeous work. The idea is by combining conservation biology, restoration ecology, and third crop agriculture with art and literature, that we can reach an audience beyond our main audience, which is the landowners, to reach folks that are, you know, hairdressers, bankers, mechanics, rocket scientists, whatever, and bring everyone or as many audiences in the watershed into the conversation, because the challenge here is not going to be just falling on the shoulders of landowners. I mean, it is the whole citizenry down there. Our institutional collaborators are Rural Advantage, and you may sooner or later run into Linda Meschke if you haven't already, who is the ED of that nonprofit out of Fairmont, the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, the Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Agriculture, an NGO out of California called the Wild Farm Alliance, which its mission is to promote wildlife ecology in farming practices across the country. They deal in many different agricultural situations, and we basically are their presence here in the Upper Midwest. And our fiscal agent, which is Center for Civic Participation, which is a democracy-building NGO. Our principal funders are the Bush Foundation and the McKnight Foundation, which has supplied most of our money, but we have other funders too that have stepped up. I guess from the standpoint of you guys, the policymakers, I think the most salient piece of the project is the multi-layer GIS map around which the essays and the photographs and the book are organized. What you see here are at the watershed scale and at a more detailed scale are these, I guess you'd call them, opportunity lands, marginal lands, and natural areas. It shows where they are and what they are. And I'm sorry that it isn't blown up to where you can all see it, because it's probably just a bunch of spots and splats on the thing here. But we can leave it up if you want to take a look at it later. The person who put this together, we basically went to the DNR and we commissioned Bart Richardson, who is the DNR's lead GIS guy, to put this map together. He was the one who was responsible for assembling the regionally significant ecological areas for the joint DNR Met Council Natural Resource Inventory and Assessment Project. And what we did was basically take the protocols for that project and selectively used them and applied them where appropriate to the Greater Blue Earth River watershed. And there's no other map out there like this. And it's taken us about a year going back and forth and with our advisors, both our scientific and agricultural advisors, to come up with something that is good enough in data to start a conversation in managing for this large a landscape.
The green represents what?
Maybe I should just bring it up close and kind of show you what's here, because I think it's hard to understand the significance about that.
the microphone, too.
This is sort of the Greater Blue Earth Watershed. This is on a really high level.
Turn the mic so that you can be picked.
Oh, okay.
That's okay.
Yeah. And I'll try and talk louder. This is kind of a watershed map on the really high level. And so you can start to see, you know, some wildlife corridors, which are sort of in the green here. They're patches of land that has been set aside in some form. It could be like WMAs, CRPs, CREP, you know, different kinds of wildlife management areas. You know, it's pretty spotty at this level. But when you go down to the lower level to explode it, and we've done this in many different, you can do it in any parts of the watershed. This is like south of Mankato here. You can start to see a lot of things going on. And what we're trying to get at here, one of the big issues we had at the very beginning was, you know, this is going to be an agricultural landscape. You know, it's going to remain an agricultural landscape. It's not going to be a wilderness area. You know, so how can we piece together enough pieces to have, you know, some viable wildlife corridors, some clean water, that sort of thing. And so what can we put together? So what this map shows here, the dark green are sort of ecological patches, which are like significant areas that are in some form of set aside right now, if it's CREP, CRP lands. You can't see these very carefully here, but there's a lot of stippled areas, and these are what we are calling third crop candidate lands. And third crops are sort of a whole range of things. They're, you know, cellulosic biofuels, some of the stuff David Tim was talking about in terms of prairie grasses. There's, you know, some of the oilseed crops, camelina, flax, the hazelnuts, a whole range of crops, the hunting leases. They're kind of everything except corn and soybeans that could fit into some of these marginal lands. And it's really, we feel like these marginal lands plus some of the conservation areas are sort of the baseline of how you piece together wildlife corridors in an agricultural landscape like this and get some of the function back in that landscape. And we started out thinking, you know, this was somewhat of a daunting task, and as we looked at the watershed, there was like around the edges a lot more, you know, in some form of conservation than there was inside the watershed itself. But as we started looking at, and we took those lands that were not really optimal for corn and soybeans, the ones that had slopes greater than 6%, the ones that had really hydric or gravelly soils, you know, that really either got, you know, flooded out, they couldn't be drained enough, the marginal lands where corn and soybeans didn't belong. And it actually turned out to be about 18% of the landscape, which is a fairly significant piece. You know, now if those lands could, you know, in addition to provide wildlife value, if there could be some benefit to the farmers in terms of being able to harvest from that, you know, if it's coppicing, you know, hybrid poplar for some, you know, cellulosic biofuels, if it's growing prairie grasses that can be periodically harvested for biofuels too, you know, some of the oilseed crops that might go into biodiesel. You know, there's a lot of opportunities there that we hadn't really seen originally. And you know, as we started working through this, we've met, you know, a lot of farmers, you know, in different parts of the watershed. We've been interviewing people who have, as individuals and collectively, been trying to, you know, take some conservation actions. And we have this one amazing group down. It's the Sheik Kittleson Group, which is an area where they've got a lot of land that isn't suited to corn and soybeans. It's a fair amount of topography there. And so they've converted that to a lot of, you know, wildlife areas through CREP and CRP. You know,
this is actually it. This is the collection of landowners have gotten together and in the course of 6 years totally changed former production.
Yeah, there's probably about how many thousand acres are going into this? It's a number of different watersheds coming together.
5,500 acres have,
and
you know,
they've gotten in 3 years been able to have, you know, a tremendous number of fish and wildlife come back into that area. You know, and this is an area that's basically set aside for hunting. You know, there's other farmers out there who are, you know, really, you know, struggling. You know, the Farm Bill drives what's growing on the land. I'm sure all of you absolutely know that. You know, it's an insurance policy for farmers that if they don't have a crop for some reason, they've at least got, you know, the insurance policy of a subsidy there. It's easy to get bank loans because, you know, the banks will note there's a government backup behind that. And for farmers who kind of go in off the grid, we're calling it, people are trying to piece together through rotational grazing or, you know, some, you know, raising turkeys, some wetland banking, you know, some maybe organic soybeans and things like that. It's a lot more effort on their part and a lot more risk to kind of piece some of that together. But, you know, as we've been going through the watershed, we've met a lot of people who are actually, you know, doing that without a fair amount of support. And, you know, I guess a couple things we wanted to, you know, share today was, you know, this is not a sacrifice area down here. It isn't just, you know, as many people have thought about it, you know. There does need to be, you know, functioning ecosystems, healthy water, you know, clean air in every place, and that, you know, even in a place here that's highly probably, you know, huge portion of corn and soybeans, you know, there are enough pockets of marginal lands there, you know, to piece together, you know, the wildlife corridors. And what we're hoping with this map is that, you know, for policymakers who, you know, want to target certain areas for either, you know, buying up land or target certain incentives, you know, for NRCS people, you know, this map can sort of point them into directions like where, you know, where are likely, where are the candidate landowners, the candidate lands. And right now it's, you know, it's in this form. We're hoping to get it up on the Internet with Bart's help, like in the next couple of months, so that, you know, it can be available as a policy tool, you know, for people.
Senator Parastow has a question.
Thank you. Either of you or both of you, do you feel that this particular shed, which you've discovered in this shed, is probably easily reproducible around the state?
Absolutely.
Because there are a lot of them that look like this.
Absolutely.
If you get down to finding out everything.
Yeah, because what was really one of the real challenges at the very beginning was, you know, in going to the DNR too, you know, they have their criteria for how they evaluate, you know, wild, you know, potential for wildlife, and, you know, a lot of what was down here sort of fell out of those categories. You know, it's not the Boundary Waters Wilderness Area. Although it's really amazing, there's more shoreline in this watershed than there is in the Boundary Waters, believe it or not. You know,
this may be apocryphal. I don't know.
Nevertheless, I think what we've been able to do here is come up with some criteria that can be applied to other agricultural watersheds to help identify, you know, where are those candidate, where are the marginal lands that really don't belong in corn and soybeans that farmers fight year after year after year after year, and sometimes they get a crop off of. You know, those can be planted in, you know, in prairie, which has a lot of other values added back in the landscape. And, you know, we had people contact us from the Chippewa watershed, which is a little bit further, you know, up northwestern Minnesota. The DNR was interested and still is interested in taking some of this methodology and applying it across the southern part of the state in terms of potential. And this data is the best data we have right now. You know, we've got, I think, land use from 2006 land use cover. And, you know, things shift. You know, land comes in and out of CRP. But it was remarkably accurate, and it's enough of a tool that they found it very useful to go out and actually use this as a starting point for targeting areas. So we, you know, the thing that has been so striking to us, you know, I grew up in corn and soybeans country in northwestern Iowa. You know, it was a lot more diverse when I was a kid. But the building blocks are there. You know, the waterways in these watersheds now, the rivers and streams are still there, but it's really the ditches. You know, those ditches have to be made, you know, through meandering and other ways, filtering some of those pollutants. And there's people at MPCA and other places that have sort of worked through some of those models. You know, so one thing is helping change some of those ditch laws so it's a little bit easier to re-meander those ditches so that they're, a little bit of the cleanup is happening along the way. And the other building block besides that is the marginal lands, which, you know, they aren't really being used right now for, you know, producing food. They can be used to produce some fuel. They can also, if they're mowed and, you know, operated properly, can provide some wildlife habitat, you know. So we're really encouraged, and we kind of went into this thinking, oh, my God. this is really going to be a hard project, but so anyway, we wanted to share this with you. I think it's really been encouraging for us, and we're hopeful this will be a useful tool in terms of, you know, helping.
I want to underscore that this is not something, if you were a landowner, you would not take this map and then try to actually do something on your own land. This is a conversation starter. It's something that sets the context in which strategies can be used or can be formulated.
There's another building block, and that's why we had the roadsides for wildlife folks on the schedule. The roads are
exactly
the ultimate corridor.
Exactly.
And it would be. We're hoping to hear. There's so many great things going on with the conversations going on that end. That at least if you folks can have a little chat, exchange cards.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Because part of it's weaving all this together.
Yep.
You know, so there's enough different pieces. You know, because there's never been a magic bullet for anything. I mean, the diversity of solutions is usually what is the real solution. You know, so if you can weave together the roadside pieces, you know, some of the prairie grasses in these marginal areas, you know, for cellulosic biofuels, you know, leave the corn and soybeans where it's optimal, get it out of places where it's not, you know. It's, you know, with some of the corn, also as people starting to work right now with doing cover crops with corn, which is major. I mean, it's really major. At least you have something else in rotation, you know, to replenish the soil. So I think there's a lot of exciting things going on out there, and you're right, trying to put the different pieces together and work cooperatively is what's going to make the difference.
Has the DNR been interested, helped, reacted at all to what you found?
Yeah, Kathy Fushi down, who's been the DNR planner in the southern region, has been kind of a champion and was one of the original originators for our project. So we've been working with her pretty carefully. And then Linda Meschke, who's coming at it from Rural Advantage, she's been doing a lot of the biofuels, third crop type work. They've been kind of, and it's been bringing the two of them together, you know, the conservation side plus the alternative cropping piece. That
The personnel on the ground have been extremely supportive.
Yeah.
With DNR, people who are out there actually working with the landowners. It's one of the things that energizes us.
And the NRCS people, you know, I mean, because a lot of these people have been working, you know, by themselves for a long time and, you know, been making things happen. And they're just sort of excited to kind of see it being put together on more of a watershed level. I'm probably not talking about this, am I?
Our conversations are recorded on a tape, so it's helpful when possible to speak into the microphone.
Right into the microphone.
Yeah.
Well, just grab
it. Just go back to the table.
Okay.
And she can hold that up while you speak.
You can probably put it down. Can you guys see it?
Are there any other questions? Or, you know, we can also, if people are interested, make this. You know, BART at the DNR can take any part of this larger watershed map and explode it, you know, into smaller areas where you can start to see the detail of, you know, where are the areas that aren't really optimal for corn soybean production because of the soil types and the topography, that sort of thing. So,
Senator Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned the number 19%. And I didn't quite catch what that was. If that was the area that were
actually, this is we did a percentage count of all lands that you see up there that are are colored, and they come to about 24% of the whole watershed when you add up all those riparian forests and the CRP lands and the WMAs. The area now in production, that is in corn and soybeans, that are designated
marginal, this is the stippled areas, come to 18%. So you're talking total third crop lands being 24%, and the amount of lands now in production that ideally could be used for third crop comes to about 18%. And the point being that we're not talking about the eradication of corn and soybeans. It's a sharing of the land area.
Okay, Mr. Chairman,
follow up,
and Mr. Shepherd.
Yes.
Are you talking about 18% or 24% of all the tillable land in the area? Or are you talking about all the land, counting roads and towns and?
I believe
water and so
that
forth.
That figure came from Bart, who did the computation off of the computer models. And
I think it's excluding the cities, but I think it's including everything else.
Including roads.
Well, maybe not roads. It includes the rivers. It includes the rivers. Things in some form are set aside.
Okay.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for Mr. Shepherd and Ms. Westmoreland for bringing this to us. It helps me focus a little bit more on the possibilities when we're talking about dedicated funding and habitat. Sometimes I struggle to visualize in farm country what we might do for habitat, yeah. and the idea of what you see there is the potential in these watersheds, and the whole idea that there might be some third crops that might make it realistic that farmers may help us out on that type of thing is good to see. So I thank you for that.
Yeah. There are a lot of experiments going on right now in attempts to develop markets in some of those third crops, because that's critical. There needs to be some economic return coming. It can't just be, set aside.
A benefit to this information can be to help concentrate the efforts of organizations like Bowser when they're talking to, when they're out there talking to landowners, and there's so many out there, sometimes you think that feel that it's a futile effort or never ending.
Right.
But if we can figure out through the GIS mapping where the marginal lands are, you figured it out, we can concentrate our efforts there.
Absolutely.
Big difference. Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just wondering if you have a plan in your watershed for kind of the next steps. Mm-hmm. Where do you want to try to take this specifically?
Well, we have, we're talking to, first of all, publishers, mm-hmm. because we've had some interest from the University of Minnesota Press, and we've also had interest from Milkweed. They want to see some writing, and I'm in the process of doing that. But they like the concept. The idea after that is to bring the people that we have been talking to together in a kind of a campaign. Initially, this is the book gets in the hands of the SWCD and NRC agents. The NRCS and SWCD agents get it into the hands of landowners. But we've been sort of batting about the idea of putting together an event that would launch a campaign that would be based on the focus would be on dealing with bringing citizens in to try to come up with with solutions on a landscape level or a big regional level, and the people that would be or the groups that would be instrumental in, I mean, we are not community organizers, and but there are a lot of people, a number of people down there who are good at that, and we have been talking to them as well. And the Bush Foundation and McKnight Foundation have asked us the same thing. Is there something we can do to fund a next step? And we're kind of talking that through with them.
I mean, this is starting up part of, on our part, as a catalyst. There's a lot of things going on in the watershed down there right now. There's third crop learning circles. You know, there's a lot of different activities going on. And one thing that, you know, this project partly got launched, you know, out of some conversations among nonprofits is to, you know, something's missing in terms of catalyzing a vision here. And so our attempt was, you know, to pull together the art and the science. And, I mean, one thing with this book, we want people to realize this is really a special place, this watershed. I mean, there's a unique history here, the way the glacier came across this landscape, the way it was formed. There's a lot to work with here. So part of it, you know, I mean, one idea was having a photographic essay where people could bring their favorite, you know, people from the watershed, some of their favorite images and favorite places to go as sort of a way to kind of catalyze, you know, some momentum. But, yeah, right now, beyond the book, that's what we're focused on at the moment, and getting this map out and people starting to work with it, refine it, use it.
Further questions for the witnesses?
Mr. Chair, just real briefly, and I apologize, I missed the very beginning of your presentation, so I maybe missed you talking about it, but I would be, besides the habitat, I mean, we talk about these programs all the time that we're trying to figure out how to put them together in ways, clean water legacy, dedicated funding for habitat, and as well as the agricultural set-aside programs, trying to put them all together to come to the, you know, these win-win solutions. And one thing that I'd be really interested in also is the impact on water, and I don't know if you talked about that at the beginning.
We didn't, but it is, we mentioned that these lands are particularly suited for purifying waters coming off of those production lands, slashings.
Yeah, we've been looking a lot at, and this is kind of an area of my expertise, a lot at particular crops that are good at, or particular plants that are good at filtering certain nutrients. Certain fungi can break down PCBs and other, you know, kind of toxins and things like that. So, you know, we are looking at that really carefully in terms of, you know, the ditches moving through and, you know, what can be planted along the sides of those ditches in those buffers, you know, to help with the water quality issues, what needs to, where do the buffers need to be wider because of the topography and the size of the catchment area, where can they be narrower. So, yeah, we are giving quite a bit of attention to that.
Mr. Chair, well, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, I'd love to see a whole watershed that put in place all these land use practices that would have so many benefits that we could measure the impact on what your water is like
wouldn't
now
that
and what
be
it would
nice.
Look like
wouldn't
later.
Actually, there has been an effort there, and it happened right here. The university is involved in this particular watershed. Let's see.
The Kittleson.
The Kittleson. This is Kittleson property. It is separated from this, which is more or less a chain of wetlands and peaty bog lands. This is a basin that was created wetland by... done by the landowner, who is also part of this landowner consortium that's changed this landscape. So the university has got several monitors around the edges of this particular wetland, and they have monitors at the mouth of this chain of conservation lands coming off of here, and they've compared the brew coming out of those
out of those tile lines. Over 90% of the lands around this basin are production lands. And here you're talking about lands that have been strategically put together so that they absolutely purify, you know, waters. Mm-hmm. And what you're seeing is they have some actual hard figures that compare the two. And what is becoming clear is that the headline here is that there's hardly anything in the way of nitrate, nitrogen, and phosphorus coming out of here, but a fair amount that still that gets into this basin. And the headline there is confirming what I guess a lot of people know anyway, that farmers on those production fields have to change their tillage and planting practices in order for these marginal lands to really have an impact. It's like everything is.
But on the other hand, there's a lot of things happening there with potential in terms of some of the biological agriculture stuff, getting cover crops in under corn. You know, there's technologies starting to offer some solutions in that way that we can mitigate some of those impacts. So
we are over our time.
Yes, we are.
But this is great stuff. We want to thank you for enlightening us on this kind of new discovery. And we really appreciate you being here. And do connect up with the roadsides, folks.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Members, before we adjourn, in your packets, there is an invitation to the Wildlife Rehab Center open house this Sunday from noon to 4 p.m. A lot of you have seen this center in the news recently, and they're having an open house and have invited us to attend.
Thank you very much.